Good morning.
Good morning.
Made it here a bit earlier today. I'm walking to campus from here on out. There's no way I'm trying to drive to campus until the strike's over. Anyway, so we're now at the stage of the semester where I've got a lot of different topics I want to talk about, and I think I'll be able to get to them all. Just a couple off the top of my head. Anyway, just the notes. Who's going to take notes? So, containers, SE Linux, machine learning, security, biometrics, SIEMs, CASBs. I'm going to probably add to that list. What I want to start with today is, so I've talked a lot about how my approach to program-based anomaly detection. I've talked in a high level why I why I think it's a good strategy. But I now want to spend some time talking about how intrusion detection and related technologies work in the real world, which means what are the commercial offerings like? And more importantly, how do you navigate the jungle that is this type of product? Any security product actually in the world, like how do you navigate them? Because if you start looking online and start going to these trade conferences and looking at the sales materials, it gets very confusing very fast because people claim everything. They claim that they can solve everything. And you can't believe the hype. You have to be able to see every security technology has strengths and has weaknesses. And you need to be able to look past the hype to figure out what the strengths are and what the weaknesses are. Because that way, I mean, you're going to be probably part of organizations recommending things to get and other things not to get. You have to have some basis on which to make these decisions. So how do you tell them apart? That's kind of the first level of things. Well, first, you have to understand what's the input. What's the data that's going into the system? Different systems look at different things, and what they can do and what they can't do depends upon what data they look at. Some examples of things they'd be looking at is IP packets, system calls, what else could they be looking at? Log files.
Access control.
Access control is not data, right? You know, it's not. I mean, it's access control is a policy, right? Of which way access and actually access. That's actually the next part is what they do with it.
Resource
use, sure. Let's be So let's say OS statistics. We get to the very important question, which is data sources can be a little deceiving. Like, if you actually look at all the system calls a program makes, you in principle have everything it's saying over the network, right? The data coming in and data coming out. If you look at the IP packets, maybe you fully understand the program. Versus, like, if I put on here, no. Versus HTTP traffic, right? HTTP traffic is part of IP packets. Email is part of IP packets, right? Why do I list these as different things? The reason why I list these as different things is because at the end of the day, what actually matters is not the data per se that you look at. What really matters is the representation. And representation of data is a concept from machine learning. And even systems in security that aren't ostensibly, the least machine learning-like system, like policy enforcement engines, let's say are kind of most traditionally not machine learning-like, they still are dealing with the issue of representation. Because this is the filter through which you see the world. If I have a bunch of raw IP packets, what kind of rules, what kind of analysis can I do on them is different than if I have extracted from them a set of email messages. It's not that you can't, in principle, go from one to the other, but to go from one to the other is changing a representation. And by changing representation, it means that certain kind of operations are easier to do versus other kinds of operations are not so easy to do. We see this all the time in computer science. For example, if you have, why do you use an array versus an object? Versus a hash table, versus a heap, or there's all these different data structures that we use in computer science, and for many of these things, we can use this data structure instead of this data structure. So by switching data structures, you change what operations are efficient and not efficient. But when we think about issues of representation, it's even worse, because it's not just what data structure you're using, it's what data you put into it, how you organize it. And that determines even what kind of operations are easy to do and what things you can't do, to the extent that there are certain things you can see and certain things you can't see. Like, if you have a bunch of IP packets, how do you filter them based on the from address of email? And if you think about it, it's like, you think you can do it. But basically what you end up doing is you take the IP packets and you transform them into email messages and then look for the from addresses. You have to do a representation switch, because from addresses only make sense at the email level. So in machine learning, when we talk about representation, what this is before you apply a machine learning algorithm, when we talk about machine learning algorithms, what are we mostly talking about? Is either some sort of pattern recognition classification problem. You have some inputs that you wish to label. You want to say this input is X, this input is Y. And in terms of the labeling, what goes into the algorithm is never just you just give it the data. What you do is you take the data and you transform it in some way into a representation that the algorithm wants. Maybe you divide it into fields, maybe you divide it into lines, maybe you maybe you take dates and transform them into some other form. Like maybe you have a date that has a string and you turn it to Unix epoch time. There's all kinds of tricks that machine learning people do in taking raw data and turning it into a representation. Now here's the dirty secret of machine learning. Is there any principled way of changing, of deciding what the representation is? No. There isn't. Now, having said that, there is deep learning. And part of the joy of deep learning is that deep learning can learn part of the representation of your problem. You can actually create some representation. But deep learning does that at the cost of insane amounts of training. You have to give it lots and lots of data. And so what we say, determining a representation, it's more of saying, okay, you have a neural network, you have some sort of number input nodes, and you have some number output nodes, and then you have some number of levels of hidden nodes. And so the idea of deep learning is it can learn the connectivity of these hidden nodes in the middle. Which really, what you're really doing all there is just, you have all possible connections, and you're just adjusting the weights in order to figure out which ones work. And this takes exponential time. Well, actually, no, it doesn't take exponential time. It's better than that, but it takes insane amounts of data. So, and the problem with deep learning is most problems don't give you that kind of data. You don't have enough data so that you can just, you know, like, I don't have, you know, 50 million pictures of cats if I want to learn what the proper representation of a cat is.
Yet.
For some problems, you can't in principle get a
record. For the pictures of cats, I'm sure there will be 50 million.
No, we have them. I'm saying that cats is an example of deep learning working. But other things you don't. But here's the really bad thing about things like deep learning, is they don't necessarily learn what you expect. There's this entire, another way that machine learning and security comes together is this concept of adversarial. You ever heard about this adversarial machine learning problem? It comes up particularly in people who talk in self-driving cars. So self-driving cars have gotten all of this information about what roads look like, what signs look like and stuff. And then some jokers come along and said, you know, if we just take a stop sign and we just put a little, like a couple of dots on it and like a little line or something, something that makes it, you can still see it says stop. It's still clearly a stop sign. It's just kind of graffitied it a little bit. The machine learning will go, well, I don't see that. It won't recognize it at all. Because what it's seeing, because it made up its own representation of it, it's potentially looking at something really different than what we are. Like, for example, stop signs, there's all kinds of regularities in something that's a stop sign. You know, it's an octagon shape, you know, it's red, it's got letters on it, you know, it's stop and stuff. It's like, what if you, but it may only have learned the shape of the top of the letters. That may be what it keyed off of. It said, oh, let's look at the top of the letters. So you cover up the top of the letters and all of a sudden it can't read it. You know, it's, and that's just because it's learning the, so why is, yes, it made up its representation. That's part of the problem. The other problem is it learned it in a static environment. It didn't learn it in an environment where the other one was trying to deceive it. There's no deception. And so you put it in the real world and someone decides to deceive it, it's in bad shape.
People who might vandalize and put in incorrect data, in mislabeled data. For example, with Google's CAPTCHA, you select cars and stop signs and stuff. But you can also select people on bikes instead of cars. As a vandal, right?
Yeah, well, so certainly there's the issue of bad training data.
Yeah.
With all machine learning algorithms, and if it's coming from humans, it can be bad. But I'm saying that even if you have a system that's perfectly trained, then, I mean, machine learning people kind of know, okay, yeah, you have some bad data, so we have to do some pre-processing, and it's like, okay, how will we deal with that? Well, we'll make sure we show those things to multiple people, and so we get enough samples, and so any, you know, misclassification will be, you know, be random errors, so we'll be able to disregard that. But it's more, when you go in the real world and start putting this there, the real world doesn't necessarily follow, doesn't necessarily have the same agenda, and so it may deceive you. And machine learning algorithms in general are not robust against that. So that's an entire open new research area which people are just really starting to open up like over the past year or two. And what I find really funny is if you think about intrusion detection, we've been thinking about this for decades.
No, I was just thinking that it becomes difficult to see what the algorithm's gonna do because you don't understand why it's doing what it does, right? So, like you said.
Welcome to the world of sub-symbolic AI. Yes, you know, exactly. You can't do that, but...
Yeah, you think it's thinking like you, but it's not.
Exactly. But it's... In general, with any computer system, we don't really know what it does. We know what it does empirically. We don't know from a first principle point of view. The systems are too complicated. And we like to think we understand... But if you've ever tried debugging a large system, you realize how clueless you truly are.
Isn't there a theorem that says like every program over 20 lines of code doesn't work as intended or something like that? I don't know, it's guaranteed. I don't know. But I heard something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, that's probably a good rule of thumb. That, yeah, more than 20 lines of code, you have to say no. I mean, which, and there's the entire formal methods area where people can prove program correctness. But proving program correctness is always with respect to a specification. And that implies that you understand the specification. I mean, I can completely believe you can get some spec of a program, maybe in a pretty complicated program, and make sure the code actually matches the two. But then that you actually understand anything but a trivial spec? People, it's amazing what you can fit into a spec. Like for example, have anyone heard about what's being stored in the blockchain? So it turns out that, you know, Bitcoin and all these blockchain-based things are essentially these distributed data structures where people put things into it, and once things are added to the data structure, it's permanent. The entire design of it is no one can change it. But a lot of these data structures can't accept the input of arbitrary data. So some people have been putting very sensitive things in the blockchain of like Bitcoin. Things like, oh, records of government secrets, or I think child abuse or even child porn, I think it's somewhere. I mean, like, some, like, just nasty stuff going, like, there's some, you're going to offend someone or you're going to set off some sort of laws. So now, is keeping a copy of the Bitcoin, you know, transaction record illegal in your jurisdiction? I mean, it's probably at the point now that from some perspective, it's illegal in every jurisdiction because of some law. So, but there's no way to delete anything by design. So, do you think the designers of Bitcoin thought about this as an attack on Bitcoin? Probably not. Because certainly they didn't design for it. So, this attacks come from all kinds of dimensions. And just because you understand the spec, the real world will attack it in some other way. And how to anticipate that is... you can't. So going back to the main thread here, so representation. How you put this into a form for your computer to analyze. What aspect of your input you put in and what aspects you throw out and how you put represent it in bits is fundamental to what you will see and what you will not see. And this matters always when you're applying algorithms to data. Particularly important in machine learning, but it's true always. Like when you talk about access control, remember we have this thing of, oh, can you, we get the question on the test, can you have two people on a Unix system set up permissions so that they can share files with each other, but nobody else? You can't do it. unless you have the system administrator cooperate with you and create a group for you to. It's not expressible in that. And that's because of how permissions are represented. To get beyond that, you would have to change the permission model. And in fact, there are other permission models. In fact, if you look at access control lists, regular users can set a permission so two people can just share files on a system without input from a system administrator. It's entirely doable. But the funny thing is, if you, and a lot of Linux systems support it, but the really weird thing is you start using those mechanisms, they aren't supported by most tools, or by a lot of tools. They will just go like, I don't know what those permissions are, or they'll just not copy them, or it isn't fully supported because most people don't use it. So even in something as simple as Unix access control, I mean, permissions, representation is a factor. So you have to, when you're really choosing the data here, you have to understand, and you're trying to understand what the security system is doing. It's not just what data is it looking at, but really to understand what representation is it using of that data, because that will determine what tasks it can do efficiently and what tasks it cannot do. So once you take the data, and then you take the representation, then what is it doing with it? Is it and the basic things are, is it applying policy? Applying static policy? Or is it applying a static policy, or is it learning patterns? And in general, for the complicated systems, they're doing both in some of these. For example, what's a security system based that looks at emails and learns and applies patterns to them? You all know this.
Hotmail.
Hotmail.
You have junk mail.
Well, Hotmail does it, but most emails are junk mail. I mean, wait, I'm saying spam filtering, phishing, all the things that filter your email so that all the crap that you don't want to see gets pushed out. That's, in part a security mechanism. I mean, because a lot of those things that are being excluded are attacks on you in various ways. One is they're always an attack on your attention, things you don't have to pay attention. Then there are attacks on trying to steal money from you in various ways. They're maybe trying to fool you, or they might be direct phishing attacks which are trying to get your credentials. Or may even have drive-by downloads or other things in them. They're malicious. I mean, it's spam today, anti-spam is not just a convenience, it's a security mechanism. And those things apply a lot of rules to deciding what's spam and what's not, yet they almost all have some sort of adaptive mechanism where you can signal, that message is not junk. And so it won't put it into your junk folder anymore. Right? Or you can say, no, this really is junk, and then it learns those patterns. Have you thought about how your spam filter is representing your emails? All spam, they all have multiple representation. I look how they look at things. They certainly understand things like from and to addresses, the IP addresses that the thing's coming from, looking maybe at the receive lines and stuff. And then they look at URLs in the emails and look at character sets. And they do a lot of sophisticated processing. That's just one little thing. Log files. This is much stupider. Spam filtering is pretty sophisticated. And the reason spam filtering is pretty sophisticated is because success and failure are pretty clear. Lots of training data. Criteria success is clear. So you have lots of, so, and lots of incentives for getting it right. Contrast this with log files.
By incentives, you mean the users have incentive to actually, they're not trying to fool the system because they get punished if they do?
The users have incentive because they don't want to get spam. The mail system administrators have incentives because they don't want to be handling spam. You know, there's positive incentives for everyone, basically. They don't want to deal with this. So, and they have clear criteria of whether they've stopped it or not. Now, contrast this with log analysis. So, whenever we talk about log analysis, you really need to be a little more specific. Because, which logs? For what purpose? Although, the industry does not do this. You know what a seam is? I don't even remember what the acronym is. What is it? It's someone can look up the what it stands for, but basically, it's a thing for getting logs from lots of systems, and ideally getting them into some sort of common representation, and then allowing you to analyze them.
System information event management.
System information event management. That sounds good. That sounds right. So you have an enterprise. You have a bunch of systems generating log files. You have them all routed to your scene, and because you have lots of data from lots of systems, of course you have now insight into your system. Not. So why is a seam a lie? In terms of effective security posture. What's wrong with the design of a seam? I'm not saying it's not useful, but there's something really wrong about it.
Is it representing all log files the same way?
Yep. And does that seem like a good idea? No.
It doesn't provide like a way of like parsing through the log?
So it does. So the classic idea of a seam is you take a lot of logs from lots of different kinds of sources, you canonicalize them, so they get them into a common representation, and then you have some set of analytics tools, a browser or something, that allows you to go through the logs and find patterns. Now I'm saying this is mostly useless. Not completely useless, but mostly useless. Based on the stuff that we have been talking about. You have all the tools for deciding why this is useless. So one common representation is part of it. How do you gain insight into that? Gain insight by finding patterns. How are you going to know what patterns to use? I mean, you can take the deep learning approach of throwing lots and lots of data at it, which is really the same, but if it's all different kinds of data, you're not going to be able to find so much. You normally have to use some sort of domain-specific knowledge. You have to use something about the underlying phenomena to allow you to understand it. Like, for example, if you're doing image analysis, image analysis is not just based on pixels. It's based on an understanding of physics of light, of objects, of scenes, of what would be in a picture. And your models take that into account. What is the nature of the underlying phenomena of the logs that are going into a scene? Who knows? It's all kinds of craziness. The idea that a common log format actually gives you insight into what's actually happening with the underlying system, because does a common log format take into account all the nuances of the systems? I mean, you use the same log format for an in-house developed application for your web browser, for your syslog things, for your DNS server, you're putting that all into a common format? I mean, they're not the same thing. In particular, they're produced by very different systems, very different programs. So you can analyze them, you can find patterns, but the kind of patterns you're going to find are the most superficial ones.
So how do they add context? Do they like slap a label on based on what application the log came from? Or?
Yeah, well, but they canonicalize it to a standard format, so like date stamps are the same, host names are the same, you know, format. But otherwise, how do they add context? I mean, maybe they do some things of like, okay, this record actually refers to this identifier, like a user. And they say, okay, well, this user, now we have a record of what that user actually is, and maybe they tie into the user database. So there are some standard ways of looking up, you know, tokens in one log and getting the full information there. I mean, there's lots of ways of enriching the data. And if you, now where a SIEM can be very useful is if you're a system administrator, and you know something has happened, and you're trying to do analysis, you can then go, okay, here's a common repository of all my data. I can now explore it and look through it. Because I know how the system should behave, I can go navigating it. But the nightmare is how much data is there? There's so much data. And it literally gives you, here's all the data. Now you figure out how to filter it. We'll give you lots of tools on how to filter it, but it's up to you. So from a reducing workload point of view or solving problems point of view, a system administrator going like, I hope I don't have to look at the scene. Because if they do, now they've lost hours, days, weeks of their life trying to go through and make sense of the data.
Is a SIEM meant for security? Is it there for security? Because I feel like something like that would be used to track what bugs customers or users face the most, for example.
No. It's not a bug tracker.
Okay.
It's for enterprise logs.
Okay.
So
accountability.
So really the reason this is sold is much more about compliance. The idea is that you have to have a record of everything that happens. So that if there is a question later, you can go back and have accountability that you can find the problem. So if you think of it as mostly a write-only data store, then it's okay. But a write-only data store is, should offend you in some sense, right? You're storing all this data for no purpose other than to store the data.
When the legal department asks for it, you can dump it all on them at once.
It's like, I want to know everything this user has done over the past 6 months. Okay. Here you go. Here's a bunch of records. I don't know how to go through it, but there it is. And now you spend pay some consultants, six figures or more to go through and write a report about what actually they were doing. The data in here is potentially useful. I'm not saying that data isn't potentially useful. I'm saying that a SIEM punts on all the hard problems, on all the important problems, which is, what are you looking at? What is the nature of it? What you really want is not the raw data, you want models. That's what the end of the day we always want, is we want a model of the phenomena. Because if you have the model of the phenomena, then you understand something. What is all of education about? It's about giving people a model of something. And it doesn't matter, here's a bunch of math problems. And if you approach the bunch of math problems by memorizing all the answers, if you're tested again on those math problems, you'll get the right answer. If you're tested on any slight variation on it, you're going to get the wrong answer. You have to learn the patterns. What are those patterns in that? I'm not saying with the work they do wouldn't be useful, but it's only the beginning. It's not the real thing. Now, related to this, CASB is a cloud access security broker. which really means it's a seam for cloud applications. That's all it is. It means that you have a, let's say you're using Dropbox, or let's say you're using Salesforce, or let's say you Slack or something. Let's say you're using some cloud-based application inside of an enterprise. You want to know what it's doing. You have some compliance things. You have to see when are users accessing it, when are they uploading or downloading data or whatever. So there's this entire product category of CASBs that is for getting the logs from those systems. And it's exactly the same problem. You have a bunch of logs. What does it mean? I don't know. You can write rules to alert on certain kinds of things. Like, you can get an alert every time a user uploads a file. You can get an alert every time someone is added to a new Slack channel. But is that interesting? Up to you.
Isn't that interesting if you care about, like, if you're writing smart, like, rules, if you're writing rules about what you care about, then everything, every alert that comes up is something you care about, right? So wouldn't that be useful?
Yes, but how do you know what rules you want to write?
Well, I mean, like, you don't necessarily know them all at the beginning, but if something goes wrong once, you can say, okay, we wrote this rule, the next time that happens, we'll know right away instead of 2 weeks later or
right.
Whatever.
Right? Right, but if we're talking about security, you've just talked about defining a blacklist. So that means you might get one item of your blacklist and that comes along, you'll catch that. But what are slight variations on it? You won't catch it. And the real way any log files are used in practice is some human looks through the log and goes like, whoa, what's that there? Because they've spent a chunk of their day for every day for the past number of years looking at logs, and they know the patterns. They've probably written scripts of their own to filter all the patterns that they know about, and then they just look at the noise, and then they, but the only reason they can filter out those things is because they will occasionally look at them, and they know the context of the system, and then they say, oh, look, there's something going on. That's the beginning of an investigation for them monitoring their systems. That's how these systems are used in practice. Some system administrators do it, but you can see it's like very reliant on human expertise, very error-prone, and very labor-intensive. Which is not the way we're supposed to be doing things if we're good computer scientists. This sort of seems just wrong. But it's a... But again, it's about, so where are the seams and CASBs in this framework we're talking about? It's not that they aren't looking at interesting data. It's that the representation is crap. And because our representation is so bad, it does not facilitate the creation of algorithms that will enable you to find the patterns that you really want to find. And so what you instead rely on humans to do the representation transformation in their heads in order to find the patterns that actually matter. And you might be able to say, oh, well, that's the best we can do. I don't agree. But that's kind of, you know, where the industry is. So then, so you look at the data, look at how it's represented, and then what's the last thing you have to look at? What do you do with the data? What's the action that's taken with the data? So what can you do with the data? You know, the thing that you can always do is generate an alert. Alerts are the worst thing that you can do. For one simple reason.
I was thinking it sounds just like you're making
exactly. Except now you're saying, really pay attention to this. But all you're doing is to whoever's taking care of the system, you're saying, here is more work for you. There may be a problem. Because if you actually generate an alert, it really means that the system can't solve the problem on its own.
The human has to get involved. And so the human goes, oh, why do I even want that? I don't want to know.
Why wouldn't they just program it to be like, you know, react to the alert as opposed to having the human do it?
So I'm saying the alert's the stupidest thing you can do. It's basically saying, "Mommy, help me." And he was calling for help. What would you really like it to do? Solve the problem. Right? But what is solving the problem? I mean, much of the time, solving the problem means is basically say no. Because that's what security always about, saying no. You realize there's a problem, some request has come in for this, and you have to say no. The access control, what is it always trying to do? No, you can't have that resource. Spam filter would say, no, you can't deliver that email. You know, it's, you know, IP packets, a firewall, it's saying, no, you can't send that IP packet. It's always saying no in some way. And what's the problem with saying no?
Makes things stop working.
Mistakes become very expensive when you say no all the time. And in fact, if you look at why do most people who are not in security hate security products? Because they say no to them. It's like, I want to log in and check my email, but it keeps saying no. I typed in the right password, but it's saying I need a code from my phone. But my phone's at home, and I left it home, so I can't log in, and I can't get my email, and I hate this. When I go home, I'm going to turn off two-factor authentication. Security mechanisms are new ways of saying no, of making the system not function. And that makes people happy all the time. Right? But this is...
And it makes people outrank you. You're at the help desk. It makes the VP and the director unhappy.
Yeah, I was like, it's just, they're saying, it said no. Make it say yes. This is the classic dilemma always of, you know, security officers in a corporation who are often the... What do they have to deal with? Top-level executives messing up their security policy. Because the security officer will say no, and then the executive says... yes. And which wins? Yes. And so you weaken security policy for whatever way, and that has led to any number of breaches by making things, you know, because it makes it more usable. And that really is the problem with the world when you look at it from this perspective. This saying no is a binary decision. It's yes or no. Binary decisions are very unforgiving. Because when you make mistakes, it's like, oh, you got that mistake. Alerting is very is much more forgiving, but it's not very friendly because basically you haven't solved the problem. You're basically saying, I have a problem, someone else solve it. But if you look at most of the security mechanisms we have, they really do one or the other. And both are bad. Any exceptions? How about spam? Have you seen something in between?
I'm imagining some old lady working in a corporation who subscribes to Horoscopes Weekly. And then gets that and the scan folder blocks it. She gets upset.
Yeah, she gets upset. Yeah, exactly. So in spam filters, you normally give users the ability to train so they can say, this is not spam. You kind of, it may have said no, but it's an iterative game. So you say no, you actually say yes, so it learns, and it works better. So this is where adaptive methods are fundamentally, you know, more helpful to a user, is when you have that training loop. Have you all heard of graylisting for email? So this is, I'll first talk about another thing that's related. When you type in your password wrong, what happens in most systems? It'll say you got your password wrong, or it says your username or password's incorrect, because of course they don't want to tell you whether you got your username right. But it tells you correct. But something else happens when you type in your username or password wrong. What else happens? Can you try to enter a username and password again immediately?
Well, depending on the policy.
Well, on most systems, you cannot enter your username and password immediately. You have to wait a little bit. You have to wait a second. And if you do multiple tries, you potentially have to wait longer and longer. Or a little timeout, and then you have to try again. Same thing for entering pins onto a smartphone. Other things is that your attempt, it will say no, but let you try again, but not let you just keep trying again over and over again. So really you could think of that as kind of a policy. It's like, okay, we're going, it could have just say, you said the password wrong, you are not allowed, I am blocking you out, and you can never log in again. Some systems actually do that. If you do enough wrong tries, they'll lock the account, you know, until someone else comes in and unlocks it. But you say this, well, maybe we'll say, okay, you made a mistake, okay, you can try again, but you're gonna have to wait a little bit. Okay, and then you're gonna have to wait a little bit. Graylisting is a little bit like that, but but not quite. So this is something for email coming in from an unknown server. So if your server is set up to graylist, if it's a new server, the first thing it says is no. But its no is such that it says try again later. It's like, I'm busy, come back later. And then it adds it to a list. And then, when they come back later, then they say, okay. This is a remarkably effective technique for stopping spam. Because a lot of spam ones will not come back. If they get any sort of rejection, they sort of go like, oh, rejected, okay, let's move on. Because they're trying to set up the maximum volume of emails, they can. They don't have the time to just kind of sit there and try again after 5 minutes or something. You don't have the patience for that. So, and people do this all the time. You know, someone comes up to you with a question that you don't really want to answer. You could say no to them, but you could also say, I'm busy. Can you come back later? And if you say, I'm busy, come back later, a lot of times the person asking the question won't come back later. Because it wasn't really that important. They don't actually care that much. So you're forcing them to care enough to come back. Why am I talking about this? Is I'm saying that in social circumstances, as well as in, you know, a certain computational context, we know that no is not the only answer. And in fact, in some societies, great efforts are taken to avoid saying no. They say, that's a great idea. Why don't we have a meeting to discuss it? You know, and they sort of put off making a decision again and again. Conflict avoidance, you know, people in societies will try to just, you won't say no. You'll just say, okay, we'll think about it. We'll talk about it. We'll just keep discussing it. And effectively, it turns into a no because yes is never said. You might say that seems kind of like it doesn't feel right. No, we need to say no, but the reason that societies often do that is because no is costly. Because now you've definitely said no, and maybe you were wrong to say no. So rather than say no, we'll just say, let's think about it more. And then maybe there's a chance you'll say yes. Because other people might actually choose to agree with them. And then enough information comes together going like, oh yeah, yes makes sense. You gather the information together and then you can make a better decision. Because that's really what it is. When you say no, and you say no and you're wrong, it's because you don't have enough information. And that is often true. When in a computer system, when you're trying to make a security policy decision, you can't say no sometimes because you don't know enough. But you don't necessarily know enough to say yes either. So you're in this kind of gray zone. So can you maybe say yes to a little bit of it? Maybe give them a little bit of access? Can you put off the access? I know it seems a little funny. I'm kind of saying computers should maybe be a little passive aggressive or something. You know, just sort of not be direct and just say, yes, that's allowed. No, that's not allowed. But there's lots of precedents. And the reason we do this is because sometimes we actually making the decision one way or the other is expensive. Now, I would love to talk about the theory of this, but there is no theory of this. No one has made a theory of security of like of taking this into account. We don't know. I have no principled thing. I mean, I have lots of intuitions and ideas and stuff, but you know, there's certainly a dissertation or two in that. And that's the thing to understand about any area of computer science. If you think everything has been done, you aren't looking at the right perspective. Certainly in security, I can say most things have not been done. It's mostly unstudied. And it comes from just, you poke at it and you realize, whoa, I don't know what that is. So going back here, what data do they look at? What's the representation they use? And what actions do they take? And you'll generally see it's mostly alert, say no, or is that right, the spelling? Equivocate? I think so. So, or equivocate. So they just kind of, they don't quite say yes, they don't quite say no, they kind of try to do something in between, try to maybe postpone the decision or something like that. But that's not the common thing. I give you some examples of things that do that, but it's not a common strategy. But it's really the only way I can see that makes sense in a lot of contexts when you don't have enough information. Because really what you want to do is say maybe and then try to figure out some way of resolving it by getting additional information. Because that's really what an alert is. Although an alert's actually the wrong thing. An alert is, yes, and I'm telling my mom. Yeah, I'll say. It's like someone steals a toy. Okay, you stole my toy and I'm gonna go complain. Damage may already be done, but you know, you're gonna complain about it. Works sometimes for kids, not always. So, one of these inputs I did not talk about is user behavior. This is when we get into biometrics. So the idea of a biometric is to measure the human, and people normally talk about biometrics as a way of authenticating individuals. But it's really a broader concept than that. Because really, biometrics is about measuring people. And that measurement can tell you lots of different things. Like, for example, we're now having heart rate monitors in smartwatches. And there has been work on identifying people based on their heart rate pattern. And certainly, you can maybe identify someone's particular rhythm, their EKG readings from it, their electrical activity of their heart. But doesn't it tell you a little bit more? You can find out what they're doing. You can find out certainly if they're having a heart attack or if they have some other thing, but you can also find out if they're, you know, maybe they have anxiety, maybe they're upset, maybe you can find out that their emotional state. It's a very rich sensor. Similarly, when we talk about things like, you know, biometrics or identifying someone's face, you know, for face ID, okay, yes, it can recognize your face. But my God, how much information is encoded in your face regarding to your current state? That information is all, you know, thrown away right now, but it's all there. I mean, imagine if your phone could tell that you're really stressed or really upset when it recognizes your face. Maybe it might not give you access to all your information or something, or might go like, are you sure you, and it says, you're saying, you start doing bank account transfers or something like that. Maybe it kind of goes like, are you sure you want to do that? Maybe I should, or maybe it sends a...
Probably just send just an odds for stress relief.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And that's the thing that makes you snap. Moments.
So biometrics are about measuring people. And traditionally for the purpose of authentication, but there's potentially a lot more things you could do with it. Same framework comes here, though. First is, what's the data that you're coming in? What's coming in? What's the representation? And what's done with it? So if you're talking about a fingerprint sensor, you've got, okay, it's looking at your fingerprint. It's got some sort of representation of your fingerprint involving points and stuff. And then it, you know, lets you in or not to a device. Can that fingerprint sensor, you know, why from a security analysis does this really matter? Well, this determines how much security does it buy you. Where else do you leave fingerprints? Everywhere. You know, like on top of your phone, on other parts of your phone, you've got fingerprints all over the place. So how do you fool a fingerprint sensor? You get a copy of someone's fingerprint. You know, people have even taken pictures of people waving their hands and extracted fingerprints from it. Cameras are pretty high resolution. So you get their fingerprint from there, you get the image, then you just get it onto, you know, appropriate, you know, shaped piece of latex or something like that. Some of them have liveness detection, so maybe you add a little dampness to it or something, make it a little warm, and then you bypass the fingerprint sensor. So this is, that's kind of useful. But how does machine learning fit into biometrics? I'll say the two are very, very closely related, or very usually competitive.
Well, you could do like pattern recognition on like using a convolutional neural net to identify faces, or like you said, you could identify fingerprints and stuff like that.
Well,
there's like real-time systems that you could actually see. Like, for example, like someone showed me like a movie, I think it's like Indiana Jones or something, and like the entire movie is just squares of people's faces as they go in and out of the frame, and they actually recognize each person.
So yeah, so certainly there's like machine learning for facial recognition, but I want to think about why.
Well, I was just gonna say, like, isn't there like programs that are coming up that could make like simulate people and make them be doing stuff?
Okay, so there are ways of maybe fooling systems. That's related, but
is it because the data set's just so large?
Data sets, okay, this is close.
So there's a company in Japan that did it with facial recognition in which they'll learn a specific features of the face, and like you said, data sets are too large, but then from those features they're able to create a 3D representation of your face. So if they'll put like a security camera in a crowd of people, it doesn't matter if you're turned away or if you're partially covered, they'll be able to recognize certain features of your face. And based off of the machine learning, know that that's you, regardless of where you're facing or what you have on. And from that, they learn that, yes, that is that person, or that person might have a flag on them or something like that.
Right, okay, yeah, exactly. Think a little more abstractly. That's all correct. What is...
So yeah, there's a lot of variants, right? There's different lighting and different, you have a beard, you don't have a beard. Right?
So, exactly, it's about variants. So when you are trying to characterize people, how would you characterize people using static rules? Because really, you're talking about access control here a lot of times. How do I write rules that say that only my voice is allowed, or only my face? How do I write down those rules? I could, in principle, write down the rules. You could say, well, you know, someone with, you know, this particular skin tone, and okay, there's this feature here, which corresponds to nose, there's a rule here, and there's a rule here of eyes, and there's eye color. And, I mean, you could sit there and you could write a picture. I mean, it's like, we kind of write down those things when people say, give a description of this person, right? We can write down things to describe it. Why don't we just do that? Because it's hard to write down rules. And what's even worse, to write down rules that are robust in the face of variations in sensor input. Because the differences in lighting, differences in background, or the thing, like you're taking pictures or a fingerprint sensor, you might be putting your finger like this or that, or maybe your finger is slightly damp, or maybe you've been painting or something, there's a little bits on it or something, your skin's dry, so the fingerprint sensor may be getting slightly different inputs. So in order to make biometrics work in practice, you're always using machine learning, because the input that's coming in is variable. Because the source is variable and the sensor induces variation. And so you put machine learning into it to deal with the variance. But that's potentially problematic now. Because now, since you have an adaptive system in the middle trying to do this, you have to deal with the fact that that system is going to make mistakes in its classification. It's going to make mistakes of, you know, maybe this is the person when it's not the person, or vice versa. And how do you deal with that?
Well, I mean,
some systems are, I mean, how do most of these systems do? They try to make it so that it's usable enough, so it has enough ability to deal with variation. But at the end of the day, they just kind of go, like, I've never seen a system that's purely biometric. They're always biometric with a backup. You see lots of systems, the only way you can get in is a password. But systems with a biometric, it's biometric with a password backup of some kind. Now you have to look at your picture of your face. Does it recognize your face? Type in your PIN. Type in your password. And the reason why is because there's a machine learning algorithm in there. And that machine learning algorithm may say no in a situation where it's wrong. Its classification is imperfect. So you have to have a way to be able to bypass it. It's the same old, same old. I mean it's the same, and we put this different name on it, but it's just data, classification, apply rules, give an answer. And the answer is generally to say no.
It may not even be the fault of the machine learning algorithm. It could just be like a hardware failure in the sensor.
Yeah, it's input from the real world. If you've ever played with robotics, you know how nasty sensors and actuators are when you're trying to program them. You think, oh yeah, if I want to go like, you know, 50 centimeters, I just need to have the wheel turn so many times and I'll go 50 centimeters. Nope. That's not the way it works. Because the gears slip, and then your sensor gets a slight different reading. I mean, the real world is messy. And that's what happens when you get sensor input. Most biometrics used in practice are... How are we doing time-wise? Good. I've got another 15 minutes? Okay, yeah. Yeah, you. 10 minutes. Most biometrics in practice are static biometrics.
So a static biometric is based on some characteristic you have that is supposed to be static, like your fingerprint, like your, you know, like your iris color, you know, your face or something like that. But I think a much more interesting set of biometrics are dynamic biometrics. What can you think of as a dynamic biometric? Heart rate. So things that are time sensitive, your heart rate. How about gait detection, like your walk? Handwriting is, you know, pretty dynamic depending on it. How about typing patterns? Are you typing a keyboard? There's been a number of systems out, you know, how you type at a keyboard, how you enter commands. That's a biometric.
A stylometric.
Your handwriting helps, yes.
And well, the words that you use when you write something, big enough.
Yeah, your vocabulary choice. But that's not so much used for intrusion detection because that's, you aren't necessarily using enough words in most systems. You aren't necessarily inputting as much. But people have looked at like commands that you have typed in a command line. Use that to identify people. One thing I've worked with a startup that's actually still going is looking at smartphones and how you swipe on the smartphone. And so you can characterize people by how they interact with the phone, not just by how they move on the screen, you look at the dynamics of that, but how they hold the phone. Because a phone has a gyroscope, an accelerometer and stuff, so how you hold the phone is based on the particular physics of your hand. You know, how your hand moves, how your all these affordances and stuff, that constrains how you do things that influence the input of the sensors, and that can be used to be a biometric. Same thing. You're identifying the human based on, you know, a characteristic of them. Look for the irregularities. I mean, there's not really that much fundamentally different between static and dynamic biometric, because even static biometrics deal with lots of variance. When you do the dynamic biometric, you're just dealing with higher levels of variance because it's coming from a behavior, not just a thing that's there. But you should be going, wait, isn't there too much variation? How can you get rid of the variation enough to be able to have a stable thing so you can say yes and no? Not such an easy problem. But there is a basic strategy. Does it involve more data? The answer is no. The answer to detection problems is almost never more data. You need the right data, but not more data. You need the right representation. And the right representation is all about putting the right bits in the right place and throwing away the rest. And so that implies having enough domain knowledge to know what will be consistent and what will not be consistent in that domain. So, for example, if you're trying to characterize how someone swipes on a screen, you maybe know the physics of how they swipe on the screen. Or you maybe know some physics of how they hold their hands. So that places constraints, which you may implicitly or explicitly build into the system. Does that mean that all of a sudden you should, you know, read the sensor to additional accuracy? No. It's not about sampling rate. You need enough data, but you need the right data. Because again, think about you holding your phone. Is how you hold your phone when you're walking around the same as when you're sitting? Is the same as when you're lying down in bed? Are the accelerometer and gyroscope going to work the same way? Are you even going to hold the phone the same way? Are you going to swipe the same way? No, you're not. How do you take into account that variation? Not so easy. But it's really the same thing. But what's the strategy for how you get the improvement in accuracy?
make the problem smaller. One way you can make the problem smaller is by constraining the context. We see this always with standard authentication mechanisms. When you authenticate, you normally say, okay, type your password in now. You type in your password now, now we're authenticating you, and then once you're done, that's over. If you're looking at someone's behavior with a lot of these things, you want to constrain the behavior rather than looking at it all the time. How does your phone move when you're playing a game? Have you ever tried playing a first-person shooter on your phone? A little funny. You do funny things with your phone that is not like you regularly reading Facebook or something. You know, it's a bit of a weird thing, but think about an algorithm that's looking at how you hold your phone. That's going to look pretty strange. So clearly, you don't want to be including the game-playing activity in with your web browsing activity, with your social media activity, with your email activity. Those are different things. So it's all about when you learn, you want to learn in a constrained environment. And that's what happens with these other things. When you're looking at log messages, when you're saying you're looking at things, it's all about learning in a constrained environment. And they are, and they, if you look at any of these systems, they always come up with a representation. And the representation itself makes sure you learn in a constrained environment. What is policy creation? Policy creation is saying, I'm gonna have a human learn the pattern and then write down the pattern and manually input it to the system. It's not really very different. It's just how much work is it to generate the policy? We have these domains where generating policy by hand is really, really painful. Whenever it's really, really hard to generate policy, we generally stick an algorithm, a machine learning algorithm, in front of it to try to generate the policy for us. But the policy that's generated is bad in some dimension, typically. It's limited. In terms of its accuracy, precision, whatever, it's not a perfect policy because it wasn't created by a human. But wait, human-created policy is also a problem. But we don't report that. What are antivirus things often? Well, some of those are hand-created, some of those are automatically created. If you understand that as a computer scientist, we're very limited in our creativity, you'll understand a lot about what we do. We apply different names to doing the same things over and over again in different contexts. And if you're a good computer scientist, you'll be able to abstract that away and be able to say, oh, that's just that. It gets a little depressing when you really look at it that way. But it's a useful way. So am I out of time? Yes, I am. I'm just about out of time. So if you have not gotten your midterm back, we have the midterms here. So we can hand those back. Please get the assignment done for Monday. Any questions? It's pretty simple.
The last three questions on the assignment two, they're not exactly the same as the first three questions on assignment two. You're still asking about the verifying images for the ISO or installed.